The reading is from Luke, and it's chapter 6, verses 17 to 26. Jesus has just picked his 12 apostles, and the story continues. He went down with them and stood on a level place. A large crowd of his disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem and from the coastal regions around Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by evil spirits were cured, and the people all tried to touch him, because power was coming from him and healing them all. Looking at his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. For this is how their ancestors treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for this is how their ancestors treated the false prophets." When I was growing up, I used to watch a program called The Good Life. I don't know whether any of you ever watched The Good Life. The Good Life with Tom and Barbara. If you didn't watch it, it was basically about a couple called Tom and Barbara. Tom, who had decided on his 40th birthday to give up his job making plastic toys for breakfast cereals, and with his wife Barbara to live a sustainable life, which these days, I guess you'd say, well, it's not really that unusual. But back in the day, 1975, it would have been slightly odd. And, of course, Tom and Barbara didn't move to a farm or anything like that. They continued to live in their house in Surbiton, next to their neighbours, Margot and Jerry, which, of course, created a whole load of fun, didn't it? Because there were Tom and Barbara with their pigs and their cockerel and their lifestyle of making the ground create what they wanted to eat. And there was Margot and Jerry, with their parties and their business and their, oh, such a proper way to live. And basically the programme revolved, well, it wasn't meant to revolve around the two couples, but in the end, it was such a good relationship that it revolved around the two couples. Tom and Margot especially not getting along, winding each other up, and Barbara and Jerry trying to smooth things over. But basically, you know, at the end of the day, the two couples got on fairly well. There was this underlying kind of, they liked each other in a funny way, and they would support each other, and they would stick by each other. I don't think I watched the original, 1975, I would have been two, but in the 80s, there were lots of reruns. So there I was with my parents watching Tom and Barbara and Margot and Jerry every week, laughing at the wonderful banter that they had, cringing at the things that happened. But, you know, even though we laughed at Tom and Barbara and their predicament and their wonderful clothes which they tried to make and things like that, and we cringed at Margot and Jerry and the things that they said and how they were, there was something about the programme that made you feel good. I mean, Tom and Barbara had their hard times, you know. They struggled to be self-sustaining in Surbiton. They struggled to adjust to this radical lifestyle. But in the viewer's eyes, it was all a little bit unreal, this struggle. Because when all was said and done, Tom and Barbara actually seemed to enjoy the lifestyle they had created. I mean, after all, they were away from the stress and strains of society. You know, they lived cleanly, they had good neighbours, they laughed a lot, they made ends meet, they had each other, they had all that they needed. Oh, sure, you know, life was tough, according to the BBC. But overall, life was good, and it was exciting. After all, it was the good life. And it always ended on an up note. Little bit of a joke together, little bit of giggling, nice little cuddle, that's it. It ended on an up note. And maybe that's why the programme was so popular, really, because at the end of the day, when all is said and done, the good life is what we all aspire to, isn't it? Maybe not exactly as Tom and Barbara created it to be, but a life that is good. You know, a life that has its excitement, a life that ends on an up note. One that's full of happiness and safety and popularity and love and comfort and security. We may desire maybe a little bit more money than Tom and Barbara to make all these things possible for ourselves, but our longing is to have a good life, a life tucked away in the midst of society, the Surbiton of society, occasionally maybe flirting with the edges of comfort, but never actually in any real danger of going over. This is what we all aim to one degree or another. And actually, you know, this is what our society is set up for. Attaining a certain standard of living, creating a good life for people. A life that you might say is blessed. But of course, in having this kind of thing to attain to, in having this view of life, we also acknowledge that not everyone can attain the good life. Not everyone can reach those standards. And so at the end of the day, we have a world which contains two groups of people. Those who have a good life to one degree or another, and those who don't. Those who haven't attained a certain standard of living. Those who haven't known things to be okay. Those who are not blessed. Whose lives are not good. Whose lives don't have excitement, whose lives do not end on an up note. You know, lives which are normally characterised by unhappiness, hunger, poverty, rejection, sadness, pain, and even boredom. Lives which often know little money and little success. Often on the edges of society, occasionally making appearances on the 6 o'clock news, but in most cases, completely forgotten. The opposite to the good life. Lives which we might have one time or other have described as woeful. These two pictures of life are polar opposites, and yet they make up our world. Of course, you know, many of us live life in between. You know, we have a mixture of the two to some extent. We never attain a completely good life without pain or anything like that, but our aim is always to try and create and live the good life. That's what we want. That's what we're told is right. And you know, in many ways, this is our worldview today. This is the picture of life that we hold to. And it's really not that dissimilar from the one that the Jewish people held to in the passage which we're looking at just now, which we've just read. Because, you see, here in the Bible, just like us, people had grown up with a specific understanding of how life worked. There were things that they wanted to aim for. There is a certain standard of life to be had. And it wasn't just any understanding of life cobbled together or got from the good life or whatever. It was actually an understanding which had been built on solid foundations, an understanding that was actually based on the Jewish Torah, if you like, the Jewish law. It was based on something solid, going back to the time of Moses, to the days of the Israelites, coming out of God's mouth. It was something solid which they based their lives upon, the Jewish law and tradition, the bedrock of the Jewish faith. And the reason life was based on this Jewish law and tradition was because in the Jewish law, a certain way of life had been laid out. A way of life that was established back in the day and had been built upon by the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the teachers of the law. A certain worldview which painted a specific picture of the good life. A life that had all the elements you would expect. Happiness, safety, popularity, love, comfort, security, excitement. It was a life that was based on following God and obeying his commandments. And if that was done, life would be good. Or as the book of Deuteronomy puts it, if you fully obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commands that I give you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations on earth. All these blessings will come on you and accompany you. If you live this prescribed life, you will be blessed. You will obtain the good life. But of course, as with us, there was also the opposite proposition. A life which was not so good. One which was again characterized by unhappiness, hunger, poverty, rejection, sadness, and pain. A life that was based upon rejecting God and not following his commandments. A life that would be bad, even woeful, or as the book of Deuteronomy puts it again. However, if you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I am giving you today, all these curses will come on you and overtake you. If you don't live this prescribed life, you will be cursed. You will not attain the good life you aim for. Do you know, it sort of makes me think a little bit, this is how my mind works, of the film Chicken Run. Anyone seen the film? And basically Chicken Run's about a lot of chickens who are kept captive in the run, and the owners who want to make pies, chicken pies, out of the chickens. And so they get this huge machine. Chickens go in, pies come out. That's what they say, in case you think I'm just being a bit stupid. And anyway, in this machine, there is one tube in the middle where everything goes down. Vegetables, chickens, everything. And at the bottom of the tube, there is a separation. Veg one side, meat the other. And there's a flap that flips over. And the veg goes down one side, the chickens go down the other, and now lots of different things happen to them, and they come together, and they end up as chicken pies at the end. But there's that moment when everything is separated. No chicken goes down the veg, and no veg goes down the meat. They all stay separate. And, you know, this is a bit like what the life was like for the Jews in the time of Jesus, as they grew up with this understanding of blessing and curse. It was clearly separated. There were those who were blessed because they followed God and his commandments. And there were those who were cursed because they hadn't done what God wanted. And those who were cursed lived on the edge of society. You know, they were rejected. They were dismissed. They were forgotten because they probably had done something wrong, everyone thought. And of course, lives overlapped a little. But basically, the aim was to try and create and live the good life, the blessed life. And so, you know, I guess as Jesus arrives in our passage today, having chosen his 12 disciples and travelled to a place where he can then teach them his ways, knowing him as we do and all the stories we've read about him, and the way that we know him, it's no real surprise that Jesus' arrival is greeted by a certain group of people. Those who have not attained what society offers. You know, namely those who, as the Bible said, have come to hear him and be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by evil spirits. Those on the outskirts of life. Those who hadn't attained the good life. Those who were not blessed. It's no real surprise that when Jesus arrives on the level place to teach his disciples, those who surround him initially are those who were described as woeful or even cursed. Because, I mean, in a society that was built to live the good life, where else would these people go? Who else would they turn to? Where else would they find help? The world they lived in wasn't set up for them. The worldview they inhabited didn't look kindly on them. They were, in effect, right at the bottom of the heap. And so when Jesus appears, freely healing and touching and restoring them, it's no real surprise that they run to him, because there's nowhere else for them to go. It's no real surprise. And yet what is surprising is that as Jesus reaches out to those at the bottom of the heap, as he reaches out to those who life has given up on, as they surround him and he smiles at those who have been ignored and he touches the untouchables, what is surprising is that he looks at his disciples and he says, "Blessed. Blessed are you who are poor. Blessed are you who are hungry. Blessed are you who are weeping. Blessed are you who are persecuted. Blessed are these who have always been thought to be cursed. For yours is the kingdom of God. You will be satisfied. You will laugh. You will rejoice. Blessed are these rejected ones. For yours will be the good life." And as if that wasn't strange and shocking enough, he continues, "But woe! Woe to you who are rich. Woe to you who are well fed. Woe to you who laugh. Woe to you who are popular. Woe to you, you who have always considered yourselves blessed. For your kingdom is already here. You will go hungry. You will weep. You will be sad. Woe to you, for you are living your good life now." As Jesus stands there, surrounded by the lives of those at the bottom of society, who had always been classed as cursed, who had never been able to attain what society says you should attain, he makes an astonishing announcement. An astonishing announcement which sends shockwaves through society. An astonishing announcement which shakes religion to its core. Which attacks all that people had ever been told to live for. An astonishing announcement which says these values, this way of life, this way of life you have created, this is not God's way. You may have based it on solid foundations. You may have expanded it in very clever ways. You may have painted a really great picture of the good life. But this is not God's way. This is not God's way. Not even close. As Jesus stands surrounded by the lives of those at the bottom of society, he makes an astonishing announcement, which in effect takes the world everyone has ever known, the values it has, the views it holds, the systems it works through, the way it has always seen life, and he takes the religion of the day, which in effect believes the same things, and he flips it on its head. He turns it upside down. He lifts those up who were at the bottom of the pile, and he replaces them with the lives we all aspire to have. He takes the good life and he turns it upside down. He totally rearranges the world. And by doing this, he renders all that we have ever relied on as useless. He starts at the bottom of the heap and he makes it the top. He creates a completely new landscape. It makes me think of a film that I again watched when I was younger, but has been remade recently, called The Poseidon Adventure. Anyone ever seen this one? The Poseidon Adventure is basically about a cruise liner making its final voyage from, I don't know, New York to Athens or somewhere like that, full of people who've got the money to go on this amazing ship, the final voyage. Oh, it's got wonderful things in, you know, tables and chairs and beds. All those things that, you know, you rich people would pay for. Don't mean you, I mean you. And They go on this cruise ship, and of course you know it's going to be disaster, because you think Titanic, and you think Poseidon Adventure, and you think disaster. And partway through this trip, it's New Year's Day, they're all celebrating in their fancy clothes, and you know, they've got the big Christmas tree. Suddenly, there's an earthquake under the sea, creating a massive wave. A tsunami, which apparently is not very accurate in the middle of the sea. So in the second version, they redid it to be accurate. But anyway, it comes and it hits the ship, and it turns the Poseidon, the SS Poseidon, completely on its head. So the bottom of the ship is now sticking out of the water, and the top of the ship is now pointing downwards. It turns it completely upside down. And of course, hundreds of people die in the initial turning over of the ship, but there are a few survivors, some of them clinging to the tables, which are now on the ceiling. It's not funny, but if you see the film, it kind of is. And they're in the big ballroom, and they have a choice to make. Do they stay where they are, cowering in this new environment, not knowing what to do, clinging onto the things they know, the tables and the chairs and the Christmas tree, waiting for someone to rescue them? Or do they follow a small group of people who decide they're going to try and navigate this new landscape? Walk over the upturned tables, climb up onto the ceiling where the doors are, and try and navigate their way to the bottom of the ship, which is now the top of the ship. Well, there's only a handful of people who decide they're going to follow this little group. And they tip the Christmas tree up, and they climb up the Christmas tree to the doors, which are now on the ceiling, and they go out the doors, and they find havoc and chaos and no food and nothing. And a few of them die in tragic circumstances, but there is a small group of six who eventually make it to the bottom of the ship, which is now the top, and some people come and rescue them. The people who stayed in the dining room, however, clinging on to what they knew, the tables and the chairs, of course, they get killed as the water rises and the ship starts to sink. And you know, by turning the world upside down, as Jesus did when he was talking to his disciples, Jesus was not saying, you all need to be poor. He was not saying, you all need to go hungry, or you all need to start crying now, or you all need to be rejected. He was not saying, you all need to aspire to be at the bottom of the heap in society. But he is saying, God's way of living is a completely new way of living. It's not one that supports the systems and values of our world. It's not one that upholds the traditional good life that we have always sought to have. It's a new way, a completely new way of being. And to live in this new way, you cannot simply continue to try and hold tightly to the values that are familiar, like those that stayed in the ballroom in the Poseidon Adventure. You cannot continue to cling on to what you have always known. Instead, Jesus says, you need to embrace me. You need to walk in a different landscape. You need to walk my way. And actually, the way I walk, says Jesus, is often far from the good life. Just like in the SS Poseidon and the small group that tried to get to freedom. The way I walk, says Jesus, is often poorly provided for. It's often full of hunger. It's often covered in tears. And it's often rejected. But it is the way that leads to the heart of God. It is the way that leads to the real good life for everyone who wants it. And you know, it strikes me today that as people of God, we often have no hesitation in saying we would love to see Jesus healing people and restoring people and touching people's lives and making people new. We have no hesitation in saying we would love to see Jesus do a mighty work among people who really need him, like he did at the beginning of this passage by healing those people. But we are a little bit more reticent when it comes to giving up what we have always known. We are a little more reticent when it comes to changing what we are comfortable with and walking in a different landscape with our God. But you know, if we truly desire to see our village and our country and our world turned the right way up, we need to hold loosely to the values we have grown up knowing and the ideals we have always aimed for. And we need to cling tightly to the one who walks the way of hunger and poverty and loss. It may seem a little upside down to us, but if we do it, we may actually find that there is a whole new picture of our world which we didn't even know could exist today. One that Jesus died for, and one that he will one day bring to full completion. Let's pray together.